Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Two important elements of the criminal justice system come at opposite ends of the process. Public defenders are critical to indigent defendants whose rights to an attorney were constitutionally affirmed by the U.S. Supreme Court in the Gideon v. Wainwright decision of some 50 years ago. At the other end of the criminal justice process comes the prospect of probation and or parole. These facets of the system are examined in two films to be shown this weekend at the St. Louis International Film Festival. Gideon's Army looks at the challenges faced by public defenders. Out of the Box, How a Culture Changed looks at an innovative probation and parole program in eastern Missouri. Joining us are two people featured in these two films. Brandi Alexander is an assistant public defender in Florida's 20th Judicial Circuit. She joins us by phone from Florida. Doug Burris is chief U.S. probation officer for the Eastern Missouri District. I thank you both so much for being with us. Nice to have you.
Thank you for having us.
Brandi, thanks for joining us long distance.
Thank you for having me.
I should at the outset let our audience know, in terms of full disclosure, that I have a son who is a public defender. That shouldn't have any bearing on the process, but just so folks know that that, in fact, is the case. And we should also say, by the way, that neither Doug nor I has seen his film Out of the Box yet because they're still working on it. Mm-hmm. So that'll be available over the weekend. We'll have details later. You're looking forward to it, Doug, I'm sure.
I am.
All right. I'd like to start with Brandi, and I'll have the same question for you, Doug Burris. Discuss for me, if you would, what you believe are the public misperceptions about what you do. Brandi?
I think the biggest public misconception about public defenders is that we don't care, and we are poor attorneys. Poor meaning we don't do a very good job, and we don't know how to try cases. I think that the average public defender has tried more cases probably than private attorneys. And in all of my time of being a public defender, which is almost 8 years now, I found that public defenders are very empathetic to their clients. And I think it's required in order to do this work efficiently and well.
Sufficiently and well. I think that you're right on target here with the way some people think about public defenders, that they are poor attorneys, but they're absolutely trained in exactly the same way. Do many of them, do you think, have a courtroom experience before they take on the public defender's role?
No, I think the average public defender becomes a public defender right out of law school. And one of the main reasons I think most people join the public defender's office, as well as the district attorney's office, and down here it's called the state attorney's office, is to get the trial experience because you're in court so frequently as a public defender. I go to court 4 out of 5 days a week, most weeks. So I have significant courtroom experience, and because public defenders have such high caseloads, we try a lot of cases, which is another misconception. I think the general public believes that we don't go to trial. We, what they call, meet them and plead them, meet people and plead them out right away, and that's just not the case. Unfortunately, the reality is that most cases do result in pleas, but that's systemic within the judicial system. That's a problem within the judicial system, not so much the public defender.
I asked about a public perception. What about the client's perception of public defenders as you've experienced that?
I used to get called, and sometimes I still do, by my clients, a public pretender, because they don't believe that we actually went to law school. When I first started out, I was doing juvenile work, and I would take the time to take out my bar card and show my juvenile clients, I am a real lawyer, as they call it, because they don't believe that we have to take the bar or that we have to go to law school. Most people believe that we literally get picked off the street. You just apply and they make you a public defender with no legal training whatsoever. So the clients tend to, I think the best compliment I've ever gotten from clients is, "Ms. Brandi, you should be a real lawyer." Because they don't think that we are real lawyers. And they also think the same way the general public thinks. I think that we have very high caseloads, and therefore we don't care, and we don't know how to try cases. And if they pay someone $50,000 to represent them, then that person will do a better job. The reality is that in our society, we think that the more you pay for something, the better it is. And I always use the analogy, because I'm a shoe fanatic, buy my shoes at Nine West. Those shoes hurt my feet as much as the shoes that I would buy with red bottoms would. So I just don't think that it matters how much you're spending on an attorney. I think that the general public and my clients believe otherwise.
So part of your job is winning the trust of the clients in that regard, to reassure them that you are what you are said to be. I should point out, Brandy, in terms of relationships with clients, as is pointed out in the film, that at one time, one of those clients threatened to murder you.
Mm-hmm.
Want to tell us about that?
That was a case in which this client was charged with murder, actually armed robbery and murder. And I did my level best to get him to trust me. And I thought that we had a very good working relationship. We saw each other very frequently. We talked often. And we didn't just talk about, you know, his case. We talked about his family and his life. And I thought that he trusted me to do the job that I was there to do. And I later found out through other clients of mine that he was planning my murder. In fact, he had people sitting in the courtroom watching me and following me home. And his plan, from what I'm told, is or was to have me killed if we lost his trial.
And did you lose the trial or win it?
We ended up having to conflict on his case when we found out that he was planning my murder. So another attorney took over. One of the conflict lawyers took over that case and took it to trial.
Okay. But the threat still exists? As far as you know?
I don't know that the other attorney was threatened, but I think that once I was no longer on the case, my murder was no longer imminent. It was just about whether or not he lost at trial, and he did lose. He was found not guilty of murder, but guilty of several other big felonies and sentenced to an excess of 60 years in prison.
All right. Well, thanks for telling us that story. Stand by, if you will. I want to spend a couple of minutes with Doug Burris here talking about the public misperceptions he believes folks have about his job.
I think probably the thing that people don't understand about probation, parole type work is the scope of it, and meaning that and our country incarcerates more people than any other country on the planet. In fact, the Department of Justice estimates that one out of every 15 adults in this country will serve a prison term during their lifetime. One out of 15. And that's for a felony conviction. That's not for a DUI or a bad check or something along those lines. Mm-hmm. And we think China's an oppressive country, but China has three times our population, yet we have 500,000 more people incarcerated in the United States than what China does. And these people, the vast majority, 97%, they come home. And the public needs to understand, with some hope and help, the majority can succeed and not return to prison.
Why are we ranked so high, if you will, number one in the number of people we incarcerate?
I think it's been a politically popular position to say, I'm going to be tough on crime and throw people in prison, and instead of being smart on crime. It costs over $28,000 a year to house someone in prison now. And as one politician put it, are we talking Yale or are we talking jail? Mm-hmm. Because you could put people in college for what it costs to send someone to prison. And so we can't just keep putting more and more people in prison. We got to find ways to benefit the public more.
Do you have numbers that you can share with us with regard to the number of people on probation or parole who go back, the recidivism rate?
Yeah, that's the sad story. When you just don't offer hope and wait for them to fail, they do. In fact, the largest study on recidivism that was ever done found that 67% of people released from prison were rearrested within 3 years of their release. But it doesn't have to be that way, and there are evidence-based programs that are showing incredible success in turning people that were a burden to the tax base into taxpayers.
Well, my understanding is, again, not having seen the film but having read about it, is that your operation is a prime example of that. It's called Most Innovative. Give us some sense of what you're doing that others may not be doing that are working for you.
when we started looking at why people were failing in our district, we found that 70 to 80% were unemployed. So we tackled a jobs program to try to find careers that interested people, not minimum wage jobs at a fast food restaurant, but something where they could provide for their family. And we found that these people, when they became employed, often became the best employees at that business because the employer took a big chance on them and they wanted to prove that they were right. And we've had people, large corporations, government agencies that call us now when they need some help because they know our people will be prepared and willing to work.
Yeah, I was going to ask how you made that happen initially. I mean, were you or your people going out and just pounding the pavement and knocking on doors?
Yes, and we had a lot of doors slammed in our face. And what it took was a couple businesses that took a chance and they had such great success that when we went to other businesses or organizations, we'd say, would you please call them and just hear what they have to say about what wonderful employees these are. And of course, we'll screen people. We're not going to send someone that's out of prison the first day without knowing what's going on in their background or anything like that. But the successes have been multiple just because of other people taking advantage of this.
One of the interesting aspects of your story and the office's story is a gentleman by the name of Clark Porter. He's received a lot of attention through media here. Tell us about Clark Porter.
Clark was born into a family. His mother had a learning disability. His father was absent from the film. Clark has numerous siblings from numerous other men that his mother had relationships with. He grew up in poverty, was taken out of his home, and eventually bounced around in group homes and foster homes until he ran away at 15. He received a juvenile conviction at 16 for breaking into a car to steal money to eat. And at 17, an older man talked him into robbing a post office. It went federal. He was charged as an adult. And at 17, Clark received a 35-year prison sentence for that robbery. While in prison, he initially struggled. He ended up at FCI Marion, the prison that replaced Alcatraz, where there have been more murders than any other prison in the federal system. But someone wouldn't give up on him and made him take his GED. And he found out that education was something that was huge to him as far as self-esteem. He got out. He ended up on a full scholarship to Washington University of St. Louis. He got his master's degree. He worked for a vendor that provided service to us. He got off supervision 10 years early. And then one day he walked into my office and said, I want to work for you. My initial response was I laughed. And then immediately after I did that, I thought, oh, my God, that's inappropriate. You shouldn't laugh because you know the successes this man's had and the background he came from. So I promised him an interview. And to make a long story short, he ended up being the best person that we interviewed for a position. And I had to get the permission of Chief Judge Carol Jackson to hire Clark, and she gave it without hesitation, and he is now one of the best employees we have.
I want to come back and pick up on that story and more. But, Brandy, a quick comment from me. What do you think about what you've just heard with regard to the gentleman we were talking about, but also the way we incarcerate people?
With regard to the gentleman that we were just speaking of, I'm very impressed. I think that it's so problematic for my client that they get out of custody and they don't have assistance at all because they're felons. They don't have anywhere to live. They have a difficult time finding places to live. They have a difficult time, if any, finding somewhere to work, and that causes them to recidivize, and they end up back on my desk and back before the judge and ultimately back in prison as a result. So I'm extremely impressed by that young man, as well as by the programs that are instituted in St. Louis to ensure that people are finding work and able to sustain themselves after becoming convicted felons. I wish we had something similar down here in Florida and in Georgia. With regard to my clients, I think I just answered that. Did I cover both of your questions?
Well, the one concerned the recidivism issue and the jail or Yale comment that Greg mentioned here a moment ago. You know, do we send too many people to jail? Are a lot of the people you deal with people who should not be going to jail but should be doing something else or treated differently?
Certainly. We need to address first, well, primarily, mental health issues in the judicial system. A lot of my clients, in fact, the vast majority of my clients suffer from mental health issues that go untreated. And that's why I end up seeing them and the courts end up with their cases. And rather than attack the mental health issues, we attack the crime that they've done as a result of being mentally ill and send them to prison rather than treating them. And again, that goes back to recidivism. There are so many crimes that probably should not be punishable by prison time, or at least should not be felonies, that I don't even know where to start. The United States Attorney General Eric Holder recently talked about the problems with drug charges and sentencing people to extreme amounts of time for drug charges. That still happens. Luckily, Mr. Holder has said that the system is changing, the federal system is changing, and we shouldn't sentence people to more time than they deserve for the charges, the drug charges that they have. But at the state level, that still needs to be rectified. You can get upwards of 20 years to life for drug possession in the state of Florida and Georgia as well, which is just absurd.
Well, it's interesting. You mentioned Attorney General Holder. He is in St. Louis this morning, and our other guest, Doug Burris, just left him. We'll talk about that in just a moment. I have to take a break. You've been listening to Brandi Alexander. She is an assistant public defender in Florida and the subject of a film that is going to be shown Sunday at noon at Washington University's Brown Hall Auditorium. The film is Gideon's Army. Also with me, as I've mentioned, is Doug Burris, Chief U.S. Probation Officer for Eastern Missouri's District. He is also featured in a film that's going to be shown on Saturday at noon at the Brown Hall Auditorium at Washington University. It's titled Out of the Box. Back in just a moment to continue the conversation. If you'd like to join us, give us a call at 382-8255. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back. And before we continue our conversation about two important elements of the criminal justice system, that would be probation and parole and public defenders, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. St. Louis City and state officials are breaking ground on the construction of the Central Riverfront Project phase of the Gateway Arch Grounds renovation. This portion of the work will involve raising a street to reduce flooding and to create a pedestrian walkway and separate bike lane. A new bioscience research company is opening a new headquarters and lab in St. Louis. Cofactor Genomics celebrated the opening of its $3.8 million facility. And U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder was in St. Louis this morning to visit a federal drug reentry court graduation ceremony and to discuss the Justice Department's Smart on Crime initiative. We've just been talking about that. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Well, let's get some more details on the Attorney General's visit and why he was here from Doug Burris. Doug, you were there. I know you're very, very happy to have been a part of that ceremony. What was it all about?
Yes, and in the interest of my full disclosure, I have to point out that in the federal court system, the probation department works for the judiciary. My bosses are the judges of the federal court here in eastern Missouri. We do not work for the Department of Justice, so Eric Holder is not my boss. So if I say some nice remarks about him, it's not because he's my boss. But it was a great honor that he came today. We have one of the first five reentry courts that ever appeared in the federal court system, and people from throughout the nation have come to model their programs after ours. And it's led by Judge Carol Jackson, and it was based on the drug court model that the states have employed so effectively for so long. The difference is in the federal system, the probation is so rarely an option, and most of the people do go off to prison. And with this is a reentry program to assist them with their needs as soon as they get out on supervision after they've been released from prison. And the program he specifically was here to celebrate the success of was a program that was built on the drug court model, and it involved people that had serious chemical dependency issues and graduated from that today.
Right. Well, it's a great program. We've been following that here on this program. Brandi, do you have anything like that down there where you are?
We do have drug court programs down here. They're predominantly diversion programs, that it's a way to stay out of prison and to get treatment for your drug your drug addiction. I'm sorry. most counties in Florida have drug court. In fact, I believe at this point all of the counties in Florida have some version of the drug court program, and I think it's an excellent program. It helps a lot of people.
It certainly has a different approach, and one obviously greatly needed. Back to some other subject matter. Brandy, I'll take this up with you. In the film, Gideon's Army, you say at one point in a certain context that you feel that you've become jaded over time in your job. What do you mean by that? How have you become jaded?
I felt like I saw so much recidivism that I wasn't helping. A lot of my clients came back over and over and over again, and I felt like I wasn't doing my job because they were continuously coming back. I lecture almost all of my clients. They all get a lecture from me, and I always thought that those lectures were helping them in some way, but that didn't seem to happen when I would see them come back, and I would internalize that, I think. And then the system is just geared to punish. In the film, it said that our job is lessening the penalty. And that's unfortunately the truth. A big part of our job is lessening the penalty because the system is designed to make people plead. You plead to get out of jail, whether you're guilty or not. And at the time, that wasn't something that I could accept. I had a very difficult time accepting that. That it was more the system than the attorney and the client. And that frustrated me, and it made me want to get out of public defense work.
What kept you in?
I took a year off. I needed the year. And when I took the year off, I really missed public defense work. I missed my clients. I missed helping people. And in as much as I feel like I was very jaded, my empathy is still there. I'm still able to empathize with my clients, and I'm still able to reach some of them, not all of them, but some of them. And for me, it's the clients who come to me when I've done everything that I could do and we still didn't get the results that, you know, the client and I hoped for, and they say, thank you, Ms. Brandy, because I know that you did everything you could. That is what keeps me here.
Well, we're starting to get a number of phone calls. People want to get into the conversation, but I wanted to ask Doug Burris the same question with regard to people becoming jaded. You're in a supervisory capacity, obviously, but what about the people that work for you? Do you find that they face the same kind of concerns, frustrations, because some of the people that you're dealing with do go back to prison?
I think, yeah, burnout does happen, but I think that's why we've got to really celebrate the successes when we have them. And when you have someone that's had no hope and homeless and then goes to becoming a homeowner and employed, you have to celebrate that. And so we try to really focus on the successes. And thankfully, we have more successes than we do failures.
You know, one of the lines from the film that we're talking about here today, from it wasn't from you, but it was from I'm not really quite sure it was because I just saw the trailer, but it was a young woman who said, our job is to keep them out of the box. And everybody thought she was talking about the cell. But she said, well, the cell and the coffin. Very, very striking and dramatic line.
Oh, that's exactly right. And, you know, our district, the Eastern District of Missouri, has the most at-risk caseload in the federal system. And to give you a glaring example of that, we have more people on supervision for a federal firearms offense in St. Louis than do the districts that compose Chicago, New York City, or Los Angeles.
Wow.
So we have a gang court that Judge Henry Autry oversees that gets people out of gangs, and it's a wonderful thing to experience when that happens.
Right. And Jimmy Edwards is also doing a lot of work with young
people. Right, at the younger
people.
Age, thankfully.
Yeah, yeah. Let's go to the phones. Brandy, are you ready to take some calls?
Absolutely.
Okay, we'll start with Christine, who's calling from St. Louis. Go ahead, Christine.
Hi. First, I want to say I'm sure that the lady in Florida, she does sound like she cares, but when I was 27, I had never been to jail before, never been in trouble, but I was actively using cocaine on weekends and partying. I was working. I got caught with a quarter gram in my purse. I did not have the money to hire an attorney. I got a public defender, and I got 5 years in the penitentiary. I went to Wren's Farm. I was pregnant by the time they sent me, and I wasn't using when I was pregnant. I just found out I was 2 months pregnant, and I'd been going to court. They let me do 7 months on that 5 years. When I got out, I walked that whole parole down with not one violation, had two jobs, and didn't even get write-ups when I was in jail. So when they say that they're sending people to prison for the drugs and they shouldn't, that is true. But my point is, if I would have had the money to pay for a lawyer, I don't think I would have got that 5 years.
It's that of course, is impossible to determine, Christine. But let's get Brandy's take on that. What do you think? Do you think that that's a logical conclusion to draw, Brandy, that she would not have gotten the five if she had had an attorney, a non-public defender attorney?
I can definitely understand why you feel the way that you do, given that people perceive public defenders to be bad attorneys. Unfortunately, because I was not there, I don't know everything that happened with your case and the circumstances, and I think that Don is right. It's an impossible conclusion to reach. However,
I wanted to fight it. I did. I wanted to fight it, and it was a man public defender, and, you know, my opinion was he had so many cases
that
he just wanted to plead me out, and I didn't know anything about the court system. I didn't, and I did it. I was under the influence that I could have got like 20 years or something, and that 5 years was good. But then when I went to jail and I went to prison, everybody else that I talked to that had been to jail like 5, 6, 7 times, they're all like, you got 5 years for that? And I was like, yeah, I didn't know. I didn't know the difference. I didn't know any better.
I'm going to have to take you at your word on what happened with your attorney. I will say this much. There are bad public defenders, just like there are bad private attorneys. I think that in any profession, you have a good set of people who do their job well, and you have a set of people who don't. I don't maintain that all public defenders are great. But I will say that in my experience, the vast majority of us do care. There are bad apples, and I'm really sorry if you got one of those bad apples.
But Brandy, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
It's just been my experience, and I've practiced between Florida and Georgia. In my experience, that the vast majority of us are good. I know not so great public defenders. I know them, but again, you get that in private practice as well.
Sure, Doug. Do you want to do a?
Right. I've been employed in the court system for 19 years, and if I had a family member get arrested and prosecuted, I would hope they'd get a public defender because they do work that area of law every single day, and they know the judges. They know what works, what doesn't. I've seen a case where someone had a public defender and then their family mortgaged their house and bought them paid for a private attorney. And the first thing the private attorney did was call the public defender's office and said, I haven't had a case like this. What should I do?
I've always equated it with an emergency room physician in
right.
that they see everything. They handle every conceivable kind of case on a Friday and a Saturday night. Therefore, they're pretty good at what they do.
That's exactly right.
You think you agree with that, Brandy?
I do. In fact, I've had a lot of private attorneys in every office that I've been in between Florida and Georgia. The private bar will often come and ask the public defender's question.
Isn't it? But, I'm sorry. I'm sorry if I interrupted.
You just never know. I don't wish to convey that I think that every single public defender is an excellent attorney. But I think that the public perception is incorrect. Generally, we are very good attorneys.
I don't want to seem critical of Christine, but it seems to me from the experiences I've had in journalism and in life that when anybody gets convicted of anything, the first person they tend to blame is the lawyer. Correct?
That's correct as well. I can't say. I get clients that come to me and say, well, I'm in the cell with somebody who has the same charge, and this is what's happening with them. The circumstances with every case are so different that even though you may have the same charge as someone else, you can't base your charges, the name of your charge, with what sentence you should receive.
Sure.
So just because you and someone else have the same named offense doesn't mean you're going to get the same outcome.
And I would like to congratulate Christine on her success that she's had since she's been released. She's proof that when people get out, they can be you're working two jobs, having a family and everything, can be just great neighbors and citizens.
And it could turn around a different way, too. Someone like that could come out and be so angry at everybody that they could just revert back to past practices.
Yes.
All right. I'm going to take a break now and come back and take a call from Larry, who's been waiting very, very patiently. Rather than take the call now and have to interrupt it, we'll take the break and continue our conversation with Doug Burris and with Brandy Alexander. Doug is the Chief U.S. Probation Officer for the Eastern District of Missouri. Brandy is an assistant public defender in Florida's 20th Judicial Circuit. Formerly, she had worked in Georgia. They are the subject of two films that really is the reason they're here today, dealing with their particular professions. I'll tell you right now that the St. Louis International Film Festival presentation of Out of the Box, How a Culture Changed, will air this Saturday at noon at 12 o'clock at Washington University's Brown Hall Auditorium. Doug Burris is featured in that particular film. Brandy is featured in Gideon's Army. It will be shown Sunday at noon, also at WashU's Brown Hall Auditorium. So you can learn more about that at the Cinema St. Louis website, and we have a link to that website at sdlpublicradio.org. So having taken care of that, I'll give our phone number one more time, 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@sdlpublicradio.org. Send us a tweet at SDL on Air if you want to get into the conversation. Larry, we'll come back to you when we come back. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back as we continue our conversation about various aspects of the criminal justice system. In particular, we're talking about probation and parole, and also talking about the role public defenders play. I promised we'd go right to Larry when we came back. Larry, we'll do so now. Thank you for being so patient. Go ahead.
Good afternoon to all of your two guests, particularly the U.S. Probation Officer, Chief Officer for our district here. I am a convicted felon three times, okay? The programs that they have now they didn't have before are excellent. I want to tell the audience and everyone that Ms. Hendricks, Coda Hendricks, is excellent. The only complaint that I would have when it was with the whole system is when it comes to the halfway house, I think the probation and parole needs to take a more educating role in teaching the individuals at the local halfway houses about employment and circumstances that are not at risk for others. But other than that, I want to tell you that the people that you're supervising, that supervising us, are excellent, and I am very proud of some of the things that they're doing. Secondly, on the public defender's issue, I, too, was one that always blamed the public defender, lost tons of money on paying a private lawyer. But the public defender that went to trial for me, I must say, was excellent. And when I say excellent, Carter Law was the best thing you can have in the St. Louis area when she was working in the public defender services. The two probation officers I had previous to that, I was just a knucklehead and didn't listen. But I will tell you, Ms. Hendricks took time, explained, sat down with me. I can't give her an award, but I can say on this radio and to everyone, she is the best that you have. She showed her concern, and she's straightforward. If you want to go back, you're going to send yourself, not me. But anything you need, call me. She helps me out and does a lot of things. And just 3 days ago, she just explained some stuff to me that I didn't understand. I was getting frustrated and agitated. But I just want to let you know that this is a good conversation, and I really thank God for it.
Larry, thank you so much for the call. Stay on the right track, Larry. All right. Doug, I'm sure you want to respond to Larry. He's very kind to your office.
Well, it's amazing what he said, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate that. And it's the reason that I have a job where I haven't had to use an alarm clock for 10 years because I wake up at 5 o'clock and can't wait to get to work is to hear stories like that and reports on the staff that we have. They're the real heroes, the staff that work with the people that have been released from prison.
It has to be so gratifying to see a life turn around, a life that has really had some problems associated with it.
There's nothing more rewarding that I've ever done.
And Brandy, the same for you. I know from having watched the film and having talked to you that when you get a compliment such as Larry's, it makes it all worthwhile and takes some of the jade out of your approach.
It absolutely does. It reminds me of why I do this work day in and day out.
Yeah, well, again, we wish Larry the very best and thank him for his call. Let's take another one. This one from Bob in Millstadt, Illinois. Bob, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call, sir. We've had quite a few people put in prison, and they served their time. My question is, once a felon has served their time and been released, can they vote, and can they run for public office? And then also, you've talked about recidivism. I'm wondering what the impact is with the for-profit private prisons. Seems to me they would not have an incentive to keep people out of prison.
Those are great questions, and unfortunately, being in eastern Missouri, I don't have the answers for Illinois, and I heard that you were from Illinois. If you would call the federal probation office there, I'm sure they could assist you. In Missouri, as soon as you're off paper, you're no longer on supervision, you have the right to vote. And in fact, we give people a certificate explaining how they've honoring them for completing supervision, and it has information on restoring their rights, including how to vote again. As for public office, that also varies from state to state.
An interesting point, though, with regard to the private prisons, if you will, or however you would classify them, and the lack of incentive for letting people out.
Yeah, you know, the private prisons have exploded in growth with mostly in the state system and in the federal system. The Bureau of Prisons continues to run almost every program where the people go in at our level.
Brandy, do you have any experience with those private prisons?
I don't.
It's an interesting point, though, with regard to the incentive issue. I mean, it is a business after all, and you want to keep as many customers as you can.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Okay, back to the phones. Charles joins us from Chesterfield. Go ahead, Charles. You're on the air.
Good day. I'd like to thank the folks for what they do, but I'd also like to complain and correct and back up a previous caller by noting that the public defenders of Western Missouri about a year ago were threatening to go on strike because they were overworked, overloaded, and underfunded. Thank you.
Okay, Dan, thanks for the call. Yes, that's an issue that's that Brandy wouldn't know about with regard to Missouri, but the issues that he raises, Brandy, are ones that really affect public defenders all over the country, from my understanding.
That's absolutely correct. Public defenders throughout the country are complaining that they're overworked, underpaid, and exhausted. I don't think that detracts from us being good attorneys necessarily. I think that the fact that we're standing on tables, jumping up and down, saying we need help, we can't handle this kind of caseload, is a testament to our wanting to be able to give as much of ourselves to our clients individually as we can. Unfortunately, right now, most places, most jurisdictions, don't have a cap on how many cases their public defenders can handle. Here in Florida, the Supreme Court recently ruled that the public defender's office can limit the number of cases that they give to each assistant public defender. But I don't think that that's something that's happened nationwide. However, there is a push for that to happen nationwide. Again, I just can't say, or I don't believe that it is a testament to the number of cases that we have is indicative that we're poor attorneys. I don't think that that's the case.
Let me ask you about the relationship with the circuit attorneys, district attorneys, state's attorneys, whatever they might be called in the various states. These folks generally are elected to office, and the more scalps they can put on their belt, the better perhaps they feel their chances for reelection. Brandy, how do you look at that as a public defender and your association vis-a-vis the DAs?
I think that the district attorney's office and the state attorney's offices and the jurisdictions that I practice in, I take issue with a lot of the cases that I've had that they go forward on. It's true that they are elected. In most jurisdictions here in Florida, they're elected, but the public defenders are elected in Florida as well, while they're originally appointed in the state of Georgia, and then later there's an election. I think that it's definitely beneficial to them to to be able to show that they've incarcerated a significant amount of people during their term. And perhaps that is one of the reasons that we incarcerate so many people unnecessarily. But I'm just not in their heads and their hearts, and I don't, at the end of the day, know what their intentions really are.
But, of course, you're obviously, it's very much an adversarial relationship and very much at odds, needless to say.
It's definitely adversarial. Yeah. A lot of people, the general public included, and my clients believe that we work together. The public defenders work in conjunction with the state attorneys, whereas that's just not the case. We're very adversarial. My job is to keep my clients out of jail and or to lessen the penalty as much as possible. Their job is to do exactly the opposite, to send them to prison and to give them as much of a penalty as they can get. There are cases that we can find a middle ground on. In fact, there are many cases where we end up finding a middle ground and we're able to do what's in the best interest of the client as it relates to drug court or sometimes mental health court, that sort of thing. But ultimately, I don't work for the prosecutor's office, and I don't wish to.
Do you have any sense, Doug, of this relationship? I'm sure you hear, and you were very very pointed just a few minutes ago talking about the number of people we have incarcerated. Do we prosecute too many people?
I don't know if we prosecute too many
people. For the wrong reasons, perhaps.
I think we do send too many people to prison for too long. You know, if we want to build prisons for rapists and murderers and child molesters, that's fine. But we, since 1988, every year we have sent more drug offenders to jail than we have violent offenders. And to me, it is crazy to see a rapist get half the sentence of a drug offender, which happens in our country frequently.
As you said, jail or Yale, $28,000 is a lot of money to put people away for maybe victimless crimes, if you will, that sort of thing. Let's take another call. Dan joins us from St. Louis. Dan, go ahead.
Yeah, in regards to the voting rights you were talking about earlier, they said your off papers are 12-12, you can vote. Also, if you are SIS suspended, you do not lose your right to vote. You can vote if you're SIS. I just wanted to make that comment, let everybody know.
Okay, well, we thank you. We thank you very much for that. Doug, back to you with regard to another comment that came out of the brief portion of the film that I saw, which I thought was a very interesting one. I don't remember who said it, but it was, "Give them something to do. Don't just watch them." And that, I guess, is key to what you're doing here in the Eastern District.
Yeah, and that comment actually came from Beth Huebner, who's a professor at at UMSL.
Mm-hmm.
And she does research on recidivism. And what she has found is if you have people trained for a skill instead of just waiting for them to fail, they're going to succeed with that skill. The just waiting for them to fail is why we've had the revolving door and the horrible recidivism rates that we've had throughout the years.
Yeah. Brandy, back to you. You know, one thing that a question that lawyers always get asked concerns, what do you do, how do you act when you know your client is guilty? I'm sure you're many times in that situation where you know your client is guilty and yet you move forward. Tell us about that process.
I struggled with that early on in my career, and that's shown a little in the film. But I've learned that the Constitution provides that everyone should have a competent attorney and a fair trial. I knew that going forward, but there were times when clients would tell me things regarding sex cases or children, and I struggled with their representation. I rely very heavily on the United States Constitution. I believe wholeheartedly in our Constitution, and I fall back on that. So if I know that a client is guilty, I don't give them any less representation than I would for the clients that I believe are innocent, because ultimately it is the state's job, the prosecutor's job, to prove beyond and to the exclusion of every reasonable doubt that they're guilty. That's provided in our Constitution. If the prosecutors cannot prove that guilt, then my clients deserve to walk away, whether they're guilty or not. And that's problematic for a lot of people to hear, particularly if you've been victimized. And I can completely understand that. I just have to, if I don't believe in the Constitution, then I shouldn't do this work. If I don't believe that everyone's entitled to a fair trial, regardless of what you've done, I shouldn't do this work. There's a one of my favorite quotes says, every human being is worth more than the worst thing that they've ever done. And I believe that. And that's what I turn to when I know that my clients are guilty.
Even with a public defender, and Doug, I'll have this question for you too. Even with public defender availability, are the poor at a disadvantage when it comes to facing the criminal justice system, Brandy?
Certainly. If you can't, at least in Florida and Georgia, if you are poor, then oftentimes you can't bond out. If you can't bond out, you're more likely to flee because you want to get out of jail. In addition, a lot of the diversion programs require that you pay some amount of money. For instance, in Georgia, the pretrial diversion program, which would essentially allow your charges to be dismissed if you complete that program, which consists of community service, a short term of monitoring by the diversion personnel, and drug testing, sometimes classes, like theft classes, depending on the charge. Your charge will be dismissed if you complete that program. But in order to get in that program, you have to A, bond out of jail, and B, pay the prosecutor's office $300. My clients can't afford that. Most of them can't even afford to bond out. The reality of it is, if you're poor, your circumstance is worsened because you can't get the services that you would otherwise get. So ultimately, the people that end up in diversion and get their charges dismissed are the people that have money. The people who are poor and deserve to be in the diversion program because they often have the same set of circumstances as their counterpart with money end up taking a plea and pleading guilty to a felony charge and the consequences, all of the consequences that that comes with. In the state of Florida and in the state of Georgia, if you plead guilty to a felony offense, you lose your right to vote. Your civil rights are taken away. You can't carry a firearm. You can't vote. Obviously, you can't get certain jobs, live in certain places. All of that is because that person couldn't afford to bond out and they couldn't afford the $300 fee for the pretrial diversion program. And that's just unfair.
Let me put the same question to Doug. We have about a minute left, Doug. Is the disadvantage of being poor?
Well, Brandy's making me very proud of the federal system because when someone's initially charged with a crime, there's a pretrial stage where a magistrate judge will look at the person to see if they're at a risk for reoffending or a risk of flight and see what needs to be put in place to release that person pending the trial. The bond is rarely used at the federal level, and so I think the effect on someone's level of poverty or their checking account doesn't matter near what it does at the state level.
We're going to have to end it on that note. I'll let folks know once again that what we've been talking about here, the probation and parole system here in the Eastern District of Missouri, and the public defenders across the country are subject of films that are going to be shown as part of the International Film Festival this weekend. Out of the Box, How a Culture Changed deals with probation and parole. It will be shown Sunday at noon at Washington University's Brown Hall Auditorium. Our guest Doug Burris is featured in that. Brandy Alexander, our guest from Florida here, is also featured in Gideon's Army. That's going to be shown Sunday at noon, also at Washington University's Brown Hall Auditorium. I want to thank you both so much for being with us. Brandy, thank you. Are you coming up for the showing?
I will. I'll be up for the showing.
Okay. That'll be on Sunday. Doug, you'll be there too?
Yes, sir. Saturday.
And on Saturday. All right. Well, thank you once again, both of you, for being with us.
Thank you.
Join Steve Potter tomorrow for Cityscape, and he'll talk with actress Susan Clawson about her one-woman show as costume designer Edith Head and about her appearance at the St. Louis International Film Festival. He'll talk with Native American flutist Mark Holland about his ensemble Autumn Child CD release concert at the Sheldon and with playwright and actor Stephen Lang about his one-man play based on the stories of eight war veterans on Edison Theater's Ovation series. Monday on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about advances in the care of premature babies and and then we'll talk, take a look, that is, at issues surrounding student loans and the increasing debt incurred by students. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. The program is produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer, with production assistance from Camille Phillips, Aaron Dorr, Jeremy Bailey, Kristen Torres, and Spencer Reed. The executive producer is Robert Peterson. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.